Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and traveler. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Brian.
You sound different than normal today.
It's nice to hear a familiar voice.
Yeah, you're out on the road.
I am. I'm wheeling my way across country, and it's been incredible. I've had some phenomenal conversations with people. I can't wait to start introducing these shows to you. But I miss everybody. It's a double-edged sword. I'm loving the excitement of getting to meet people in all of these small towns across the country. But I miss the familiar, so it's nice to hear you.
Right on. It's good to hear your voice, too.
So we started this journey kind of locally. My first conversation was actually just up in Carmel, outside of Monterey, with Dr. Rianne Eisler. She agreed to let me do kind of a shakedown on doing shows remote with her. So she invited me into her home. We had this phenomenal conversation that I'm really excited to share with you. And things are going to be different because I am on the road, so we won't be taking calls today. But you can be part of the conversation, as always, through our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or now we have an Instagram going if you want to follow pictures of me going across country. So just look for The Reluctant Therapist on Instagram. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can listen to shows at kcbx.org or podcast us at iTunes. So let me tell you, Dr. Rianne Eisler is best known maybe as the author of The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future, which introduced us to the idea of the domination versus collaboration or partnership model of relationships. She is a cultural historian, an educator, an attorney, an author. She has transformed culture with her activism, and she's written such books as Sacred Pleasure and also The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economy. And so today's conversation actually focused on her work as the founder of the Caring Economy Campaign and the importance of growing our value of caregivers in our culture, raising the esteem of the work done by those who raise children, teach children, take care of the elderly, and how that will increase the quality of life for all of us. So, as always, I appreciate being part of the conversation. Can't wait to hear how you feel about the show, and I can't wait to send you more shows over the next few weeks. And Brian, I'll be talking to you soon.
Sounds great. Have a safe and fun time out there.
I will. And I will. Please look for the picture so you know where we are. And I look forward to introducing you now to my conversation with Dr. Rianne Eisler.
I want to start off for people who may not have the pleasure or have had the opportunity to read your books as I have or be aware of your work. If we could talk about how you came from the work of The Chalice and the Blade into the understanding of partnership and into the idea of the caring economy. How did you make all these steps and what inspired you to start even challenging our cultural belief system through your work with The Chalice and the Blade?
Well, my first books, like The Chalice and the Blade, which, by the way, is now in 26 foreign editions and is still growing strong. I think it is in its 55th printing in the United States. With those books, I really was trying to answer a question that many of us have asked, which is, how do we get to this place where from my perspective, it's really reality stood on its head, mm-hmm. where so many of the things that we value, our relationships, our caring, nature, are devalued.
And what year did you start? Did you have that first awareness of how did we get here? What was going on culturally, and what year was this when you started to question?
Oh, I've been questioning all my life. I started questioning as a child refugee from the Nazis with my parents way back. I questioned why, we had been persecuted just because we're Jews. How could that be? I questioned when my parents lost everything and I grew up in the industrial slums of Havana and I saw this terrible poverty around me. And I've been questioning ever since. But in terms of really setting out to actually systematically from the perspective of a multidisciplinary approach, studying social systems, social alternatives, answering the question of, does it really have to be this way? You know, we're told it has to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
Or are there alternatives? And if so, what are they? That really didn't happen until the 1970s.
And so what inspired you to, was it the feminist movement and what was going on around you that started to say?
Well, it wasn't only the feminist movement, although my approach was very much influenced by the awareness that so much of what I had been taught in all these years of education, including higher education, just about everything I read was written by, for, and about people who weren't like me, men.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I did my study, I really paid a great deal more attention, much more attention, to what happens to the female half of humanity throughout history and cross-culturally. But it was really, the 60s were a time of tremendous upheaval, as you well know. And I think that it was possible then to say, well, we can try to build something better. Also for me, having lived by then in three different cultures, you know, first as a very small child, the culture of my native Vienna, which my parents carried into our home. So, you know, we continued to speak German and there was this cultural heritage. Then Cuba and then the United States. I realized that the things that people consider just the way things are aren't the same everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made it possible for me to, in a sense, break out. But the main thing was that it was very clear to me at that time, as I think it is if we really look around us, that the old social categories, you know, right versus left, religious versus secular, Eastern versus Western, capitalist versus socialist, were useless in answering the question of is there a better alternative? Because we have seen what I call domination systems, tremendously unequal, unjust, violent regimes in all these categories. So it's really pointless to continue the conventional argument, isn't it?
So the idea was that no matter how much change we went through, no matter how much revolution through the civil rights movement or how much gains the feminist movement brought, if we didn't have a new paradigm to follow, we would just keep returning to the dominator culture in some form? Was that your concern?
Well, at that time, I still didn't have the categories of the domination or dominator configuration, social configuration, and what I call the partnership social configuration. But it was very clear, yes, that what I later called the dominator or domination model would still be the norm, you know, the underlying norm, and that the rest of it would be sort of like band-aids. But having said this, if you really look at modern history through this lens of this partnership domination continuum, what you see is one social movement after another challenging traditions of domination, be it the so-called rights of man movement, you know, challenging the so-called divinely ordained right of kings, the feminist movement, challenging the so-called divinely ordained of men to rule over women and children, the abolitionist civil rights movement, challenging, again, the so-called divinely ordained right of one race to rule over another, all the way to the environmental movement, again, challenging the so-called divinely ordained rule of man to rule over, you know, everything that moves on this earth, to quote the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't just Western. I mean, if you look at the empires of China and the caste system of India and the Muslim invasions, you know, the first colonial powers in Africa were, of course, the Muslim invasions, the Aztecs. So this is not West versus East by any means, or East versus West, or North versus South. It really is going much deeper, trying to understand what are we really needing to dismantle, deconstruct it and dismantle, and what do we need to build, and how will we build the foundations for this alternative of the partnership system?
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and today, in my first of a series of conversations on the road, I am here with Dr. Rianne Eisler talking about her work with the caring economy and how we need to move from our current understanding of domination, domination over others, domination over the environment, and to bring ourselves to a more equal and partnership-based way of interacting with each other. And so, Dr. Eisler, can you explain for those who, you know, we're throwing out the term domination as if we assume everybody understands the dominator culture. Can you explain a little bit, you know, what is the model we have been operating from that you spoke of first in The Chalice and the Blade?
Well, the model we've been operating from and trying to leave behind and in bits and pieces leaving behind has the core configuration of top-down authoritarian rule in both the family and the state or tribe. Family is very important, because if you look at most of the political science that's taught, the family is simply not mentioned hardly, whereas actually it's in what children first observe and experience that nothing less than the neurons of our brains, the synapses, the patterns of our brains are developed. The second part of this configuration is something that, again, is ignored in most studies, which is that domination systems rank one half of humanity over the other half. And with it, with the ranking of male over female, comes the ranking of anything stereotypically considered feminine, such as caring, nonviolence, be it in women or men, as lower. And so this is Nazi Germany, Stalin's Soviet Union, Khomeini's Iran, ISIL, the so-called rightist fundamentalist alliance in the United States, top priority. Always get women back into their, quote, traditional place, in a, quote, traditional family, which is a code word, isn't it, mm-hmm. for a authoritarian, male-headed, if a woman is the dominator in it, she's henpecking, right? She's not the norm, and highly punitive family. And the third part of the configuration is, of course, that there is a high degree of built-in, even institutionalized abuse and violence as is needed to maintain these rigid rankings of domination. But here I want to say something. The alternative, a partnership system, is not free of hierarchy. There is still power, but rather than power over, it's more power to and power with. So we have what I call hierarchies of actualization, but I'm getting ahead of my story, because the fourth part, and this is really basic, are beliefs and stories.
Like, so where was the time, though, prior, because what you're talking about seems like the beginning of man, that it doesn't seem like there has ever been a time that there was a partnership or a shared power. Or did that exist? Because clearly that's what you went and studied in your work. I mean, that's what The Chalice and the Blade talks about. But for others who don't know.
Well, first of all, you use the term man.
Yes. Is that incorrect?
Well, is it? What does it say about women?
I'm already enculturated, right? I speak the cultural language.
Right. So we really have to understand that we have not only acquired a way of thinking and of conceptualizing and institutions, but even language that keeps us trapped. Like, mm-hmm. we have only two alternatives for gender relations, matriarchy or patriarchy. And they're really two sides of a domination coin, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
They're not the partnership alternative.
Right, I mean, someone is in charge.
Somebody dominates. Rule by. Rule mm-hmm. by mothers or rule by fathers. Whereas the partnership system is not that at all. It is a very different kind of thing. But, you know, you asked me about, we've always been that way.
Right.
It's what we've been taught, of course. It happens to be untrue. In The Chalice and the Blade, I draw from both archaeology and myths, as well as cross-cultural information. And it is simply not true that we have always had a domination system. The archaeological evidence is very clear that there were indeed, for most of our history of our species, you know, which goes much further than 10,000 mm-hmm. years, or even 5,000 years, which is what we usually, if that, I mean, usually we just thought about, you know, the 19th century, if anything, or you know, starting with the American Revolution or something like that, there were societies that were not, for one thing, male-dominated. And there were sites, for example, Çatalhöyük in Turkey, which is the largest early farming site ever excavated. The archaeologist who most recently has excavated there, Ian Hodder, wrote in a Scientific American article, with some amazement, I might add, that the evidence from both the bones and the DNA, from the graves, from the houses, from the so-called burial gifts, you know, mm-hmm. absolutely indicates, as he puts it, that being born male and female really didn't make much difference there.
So the gender roles that we talk about in our culture of how you're supposed to behave based on your sex were non-existent.
No, I wouldn't say that, but what was valued, mm-hmm. I mean, we really have to assume that in a time before formulas, women still nursed babies, and that's how babies survived, and men can't do that. Mm-hmm. So you can't say that the roles were completely the same, although there is certainly evidence from these sites that women were craftspeople, not only men, that women were priestesses, that not only men were priests. So some of the roles were shared. Other roles were not. But there's even more than that. You know, if you look at gathering hunting societies today, the vast majority of them are much more partnership oriented. And that's presumably these small bands of foragers mm-hmm. is how we lived for millennia. So this man, the hunter, man, the warrior, you know, the caveman cartoon, you know, club in one hand, dragging a woman by the hair, is absolute dominator fantasy. But we've all been really acculturated to accept it, haven't we?
So move ahead to where we are today in 2016. How have you evolved in your thinking to coming to the work with the caring economy? How did you go from this realization, this understanding in your work with Chalice and the Blade about the dominator culture and the possibility of moving to a partnership culture, to your work in sacred pleasure and talking about the sexual politics and equality, to the work you're doing now? What was your personal evolution?
Well, you mentioned my book, Sacred Pleasure, which, of course, the subtitle is Sex, Myth, and the Politics of the Body. And that book really looks at both spirituality and sexuality from the perspective of the partnership and domination configuration and how they're structured very, very differently. And already in that book, in the second half of the book, because in the first book, I really looked at how in ancient images of sex were part of the sacred art. Hmm. I mean, it's very hard for us to understand that. Figures, for example, I mentioned Çatalhöyük earlier, a little figurine of a woman seated on what seems to be a throne of some kind, although it's interesting because it was in these cultures, power was not seen the same way. But it has two lions on each side, two felines, and she's giving birth. Birth giving was part of the sacred art. I mean, so different, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And hardly any scenes of the taking of life, but scenes of the giving of life as part of the sacred art. And phalluses and vulvas are part of the cave art, interestingly dismissed as indeterminate objects by some of the early excavators who, many of them were abbots, so they didn't want to see anything sexual. So what we're really talking about here is reexamining what was, but also looking at what is from the perspective of what we've inherited and deconstructing it. So you say, well, look, how did I progress?
Right, how did we get to a place where now you're calling for action?
Well, this is it. Already in the second half of Sacred Pleasure, I looked at, even in Chalice, I had two alternative scenarios, break down and break through, imaging two very different future scenarios, the domination scenario and the partnership one. But even in that book, I already was, you know, moving towards caring economy ideas. But then I started to, the books after that, I really started to do action books. Mm-hmm. The first one was The Power of Partner. No, actually, the first one was an education, Tomorrow's Children, reexamining our educational system from preschool to high school, really, and proposing what partnership education looks like. And that, I really love that book because, again, it's a tool for change.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Dr. Rhian Eisler. We are actually sitting in her beautiful home, in her office, talking about her work, beginning with The Chalice and the Blade, working for decades to bring about awareness of a cultural shift that could be possible from a domination culture of power over others to a partnership culture where we work together to value the gifts and contributions of all in our society. And her work today with the Center for Partnership, but also the Caring Economy. And that's where we are right now, is more action. You know, it seems that we are ripe in our culture for, and especially with young people, it seems especially the millennial kids and how they're bringing together their marriages in much more a partnership way, an egalitarian way, that there is an opening right now to this idea for partnership. But why the economy? I don't know if people understand what role the economy has in equality in partnerships or in relationships.
Well, partnership, the way I use it, is not about only partnership in marriage or in intimate relations. Just as I described the domination system, I also described the partnership system, and it affects all of our lives. So whereas the domination system is an authoritarian family and tribe or state, you have a more egalitarian and democratic family as well as state or tribe. And the two are inextricably interconnected, which is what we have to really start to understand. We know from neuroscience, as I said, that what children first observe or experience is foundational to how their brains develop, and with this what they consider normal or abnormal, possible or impossible.
So what you see is the cultural environment of our families is replicated in the culture and environment of our economies or our societies? Or did they influence each other?
They influence each other. But if we fail to pay attention to what happens in the family, that's why in my book on economics, The Real Wealth of Nations, I also write about intra-household resource distribution, which is ignored in economic schools and yet is basic. It's foundational. You know, there are studies in more rigid domination-oriented cultures like Brazil, for example, where $1 in the hands of a woman is equivalent to $18 in the hands of the father. Not that men are more selfish than women, but they are taught that it's their money, and they can spend it on drinking, whoring, gambling, and not on their families. whereas women are socialized to care. Of course, today we're seeing how men, as the status of women rises, right, men no longer feel it's such a threat to their status, to their, quote, masculinity, to also embrace and act out more so-called feminine values and activities. So men are diapering babies, are feeding babies, etc. But I want to get back to what you said about working together. The partnership model is not just about working together. People work together all the time in domination systems. You know, terrorists work together, cartels work together, criminal gangs work together, invading armies work together. It's really much more complicated. It's about this configuration. Yes, it starts with the structure of both the family, you know, structures. But it also has to do with more equality between female and male, and therefore a higher value given to the so-called feminine, such as caring and caregiving, with less violence and abuse, because it's not needed to maintain these rigid rankings, right? And very different stories about what is normal or abnormal, what is possible or impossible.
So why would someone who has power, for example, why would they, what would be the benefit of handing over power or bringing equality to our culture? You know, I'm assuming you have an answer for this through the economy, but why would anyone who has a position of power want to open up and allow partnership? Well, what's the benefit to
the
them?
The benefit at our time, when high technology such as nuclear bombs and bacteriological warfare, you know, biological warfare threaten extinction, basically, is, you know, they really have to start thinking that what they have is a first-class cabin in a sinking ship. It's a benefit for them and their children to change a system where the economic priorities will always be destructive, because there are only two alternatives in this system. You either dominate or you're dominated. Mm-hmm. So war, the war of the sexes, are inevitable as we see around us.
War on the environment.
War on the environment. Mm-hmm. And this is why the shift really has to be global. It can't just be one country, okay? And that's why we work through the Caring Economy Campaign and through the Center for Partnership Studies with empowering and educating and engaging and training partnership and caring economy leaders worldwide.
So it sounds like many steps, one of which is kind of shifting family structures in such a way that it's more equal, shared duties, or now I'm afraid to say together, but partnership in the family, and also as a culture valuing the unit of the family and offering that family support within culture. And then in turn, when families are supported in the roles of caring for children and for the elderly and educating children, become a cultural value in some way that enhances our economic. Because if money is our bottom line indicator of success as a culture, how do we value the role of family and caring and make it an economic indicator, an economic success?
Well, you see, you mentioned, I mean, you asked me why would those in power
give
change?
It up. Mm-hmm.
But the point of it is also that our economic system, we are going through a massive technological shift. Mm-hmm. You know, the first massive technological shift was from an agrarian farming economy to an industrial economy, so that today only about 2% of jobs really are in agriculture. But the post-industrial economy, you know, this new technological shift with nanotechnology, with automation, robotics, artificial intelligence coming down the way, that's not going to produce those conventional jobs as the industrial revolution did. So what we're seeing today is not only jobs being exported to cheaper markets. That's really just the tip of the iceberg. What's really happening is that jobs in manufacturing are disappearing and will not come back. A factory that employed 10,000 people can today be run by less than 100 people. So we are seeing this. First of all, what we're seeing is a polarization of, yeah, there are more jobs, but there are in the service jobs that are poverty wages, including caregiving jobs, because we pay our caregivers so much less than the average wage, which is absurd, by the way. And then those on top, you know, a very smaller elite. So it's not tenable. We need a new economic paradigm. So while we have a crisis, we have an opportunity to redefine what is and is not productive work. And, you know, we know, again, back to neuroscience, that that high-quality human capital that people keep talking about for the post-industrial economy, where really even a lot of service jobs will be eliminated. I mean, already are being eliminated. I mean, algorithms are beginning to replace people in the finance industry. I mean, think about that for a minute.
And that's not a service level job. I mean, that's a high paying.
Precisely. So how do we get these innovative people, creative people who are flexible, who are able to work in teams, right? If we don't invest in care, we know from neuroscience that whether we get them or not hinges on the quality of care and early education they get. So we have an opportunity for what we're working on through the Caring Economy campaign, which is to really change thinking about what is valuable. And that's why we also developed a new set of measurements.
For the economy, for our wealth.
We call them social wealth economic indicators, and they focus on the state of our human capacity, and also, unlike even most alternative GDP alternatives, on what investments are needed to improve it for better outcomes. So we don't just look at outcomes, you know, where we are, but at inputs. What do we need to invest in? And of course, what we need to invest in is precisely what most Western European nations have invested in, Nordic nations, which were so poor at the beginning of the 20th century that there were famines, invested in caring policies, universal health care, very generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers, stipends to help families with children, education for parenting, high educational standards for children, elder care with dignity. And today, these nations not only have very low poverty rate, including very low poverty rate for woman-headed families, okay, which we're always told, well, you know, woman-headed families have to be poor. No, they don't. Because value is given to the work of care. And they have a generally high standard of living for all. And they have a very healthy market economy.
So
they're very innovative.
So for people, you know, I'm just assuming, even myself, trying to understand how the economy works or how, you know, we measure. Currently, how do we measure wealth in our country?
Our main measure of economic success is gross national product or gross domestic product. And first of all, that only measures transactions in the market economy.
Okay.
So this is terrible for women. You know, the mass of the world's poor and the poorest of the poor worldwide are women and also their children.
Mm-hmm. And the elderly, right?
Well, the elderly up to a point.
Okay.
Because in the United States, according to U.S. Census Bureau figures, women over the age of 65 are twice as likely to live in poverty as men of the same age. And a major reason is that most of these women are or were either full or part-time caregivers working for free in families with no support, as in you know, as in Norway, Finland, and Sweden, you know, mm-hmm. really have very high support, and or for poverty level jobs in the market. So you have to really start looking at poverty. If you want to break through cycles of poverty, you have to look at who are the mass of the poor, mm-hmm. and why are they the mass of the poor. If you want to have people with higher capacity, which you have to have for this new world. So one of the things that we hear a lot about today is a guaranteed annual income, precisely because the jobs are disappearing.
Right.
But what I would like to see, and I propose this in the Real Wealth of Nations, and other people are beginning to, Neva Goodman, for example, has a very detailed proposal for linking that income with care work in the non-market economy, in families, in volunteers. You see what I'm saying?
I do. So right now we just measure, you know, in whatever we're producing as a nation and what our financial standing is. We don't look at our environmental resources or protecting the environment. We don't look at the money or time that goes into caring for children or educating children. We don't value those things. So as a result, these people live in with greater poverty or less access to resources because what they're doing does not bring financial wealth to the country. Therefore, they're ignored or invisible. Am I on the right track?
Well, it depends on what you measure, you see. Mm-hmm. And if all you measure is basically goods and services that change hands mm-hmm. in the market economy, first of all, you are giving value to things that, as you point out, can be destructive to the environment, can be unhealthy for people, are unhealthy for people, you know. I mean, are goods that are manufactured for obsolescence. Mm-hmm. I mean, all kinds of garbage.
Right, so right now, the economy doesn't matter what it's producing as long as it's producing something and bringing money.
Yeah, that's right. So what kind of system is that? I mean, there are no values in this system of what really benefits us and the planet and what hurts us and the planet. So on that count alone, both capitalist and socialist nations use this system. But the problem is that we've inherited both socialist and capitalist theory, both Marx and Smith. For them, nature was there to be exploited. Mm-hmm. And as for the work of caring for people, starting in early childhood and family, they said this is not productive work. This is just reproductive work. And kids are still taught this in education and in economic schools. And it's a crazy distinction.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. My guest today is Dr. Rian Eisler, and we're looking at and talking about alternative ways of measuring wealth in our nation. And to me, we're getting to the juice of it here, of how we, you know, change our thought about how we what we value as a culture and putting our money in some ways in the areas that we value. Because we talk about, I mean, even our government, our politicians will always say that it's all about family, right? We're all about families and supporting children and doing the best for children. And yet we don't put our money into programs that support women and children. We don't fund opportunities for early childhood education. I mean, we really don't put our money where our mouth is because, as you are saying, because our indicators of wealth are all based on what brings us money. Even if we're selling something that destroys lives, if it brings in money to the shareholders, it's considered a success. So now we're talking about a shift to a new mindset of how do we measure the value of care for children and care for the elderly and education, and how does that care equate to a stronger, more vibrant, and robust economy? Because I think that's what it keeps going back to is we have to sell it to the people who are all about the bottom line, that by caring for young people, the quality of life for all of us improves.
And our economy improves.
Right. So how? Tell me the story.
Well, the story is that in bits and pieces, we're beginning to see the United Nations, for example, is now beginning to talk about the value of care work. We've had a number of studies, including a recent one from Australia, really quantitatively showing that if the work of care, mostly performed by women in families, were to be counted, it would constitute 50%, 50% of the reported Australian GDP.
I think one of the challenges, because what I'm hearing you say is, you know, we have to value the work that's being done, why it's so important to nurture families and nurture children. And so, you know, I teach in the psychology child development department, and universally what the young women will say is, I couldn't imagine ever staying home to care for my children because it would be a waste of my college degree.
Well, would it? If the college degree were, as I've proposed in my book on Education, Tomorrow's Children, include caring for life, that is, caring for self, for others, and for nature as integral to the curriculum. These are the skills that we need in life to make life more meaningful for ourselves and for others. But we're not talking about women staying home. What we're talking about is something that's beginning to happen, which is that as this work associated with women, as the status of women rises, men are beginning to do this work as well. And then we can say, well, yes, this work is really extremely valuable in strictly economic terms. And that's our, we make not only a social justice argument, but also an economic benefits argument for caring policies through the Caring Economy campaign. And I invite our listeners to go to caringeconomy.org. And you'll find, for example, information about the social wealth economic indicators. You'll find our resources, like our fast fact sheets, which are fascinating. You know, fast facts. Why is this beneficial for fathers is one of them. Why is this beneficial for children? Why always making, as I said, not only a social justice argument, but an economic benefits to the whole economy argument. And, of course, our webinars. I mean, we invite you to really enroll in our webinars because that's where you really can get into this. Because if we... See, we hear so much about thinking outside the box. There's a reason. If you're stuck in the old thinking, you just replicate the same old, same old.
Well, and it seems also that the more people who are having this conversation, then the more we have an opportunity to change the mindset, right? That the more it becomes the norm, no one thinks about a dad who stays home and, you know, cares for children. No one thinks about dads diapering children. I mean, today, that conversation has become more of the norm. So it seems the more we talk about, you know, the value of caring. The other place I wanted to go also, because I keep thinking about the cultural aggressiveness that we see right now, you know, this kind of rape culture on campus, college campuses that we've been seeing, or, you know, a lot of sexual assaults in the military. And in some ways, I wonder, Anne, if there's this backlash, because you've talked about steps forward and then steps back, that as women are gaining more opportunities economically or in, you know, universities or in business, that there is more now of kind of this pushback sexually with this rape and assault happening. Do you see a correlation between that?
Well, I think that there certainly is backlash. I mean, if you look at the modern movement towards partnership, you know, all these challenges to traditions of domination, it's not been linear. It's been like a spiral with dips, with regressions, backlash. But I think it's more than backlash. Women are beginning to report. Women are beginning to be conscious that this is not okay, that they don't deserve it, that, you know, that there's something really, really wrong. So you see both these trends. And so that's also a reason that you're seeing, you know, it's becoming visible. I mean, remember until the Clarence Thomas hearings, you didn't hear anything about sexual harassment. But it was happening. I mean, it happened to me to you. I mean, it happened to all of us. It was just considered, well, you know, you just have to kind of deal with it and not make a fuss and not say anything.
Don't call any attention to yourself.
That's right. So I think that these are both positive signs, really. But there is, see, the redefinition of femininity, like the young woman you said, it would be a waste of my talents.
Right, to stay home and raise children.
What we really want is a world where both men and women can have bonding with their children and use their intelligence and their skills and their knowledge to raise a generation that can really move us forward, but both can also have their own careers, their own passions, their own activities.
And so, I mean, you're a hopeful person. You spend 5 minutes with you, and you can sense the idealism or the idea that we're this close to being able, like we're a generation away of being able to turn the tide. And you talk a lot about the children and the education, early childhood education. You know, what does that look like for you? You know, what kind of early childhood education do we need to have to support a change in culture?
Well, I think that I am hopeful, but I'm also realistic. I mean, this is very pragmatic work. It's based on a great deal of study of where are the real intervention points. You know, childhood, gender, economics, story. Those are the real interventions that can give us foundations on which to build.
Right, because earlier you talked about the movements towards change, the revolutions towards change, even probably the French Revolution, these sent times of inequality, the reason they failed is that they were lacking a foundation for a new paradigm.
Well, precisely. I mean, and so the partnership and domination systems as a new paradigm for a real cultural transformation are something that I want to see spread, that I want people to really understand. You know, Marxism, socialism was successful because people really studied and tried to understand this very flawed analysis, by the way, which made the assumption that you either dominate or you're dominated. It's like the Hegelian master and slave, just changing positions.
Right.
That's not what this is about. And it's not about a completely flat way of living, like organization. Remember I said about hierarchies of actualization, where accountability, respect, benefits don't just flow from the bottom up, but both ways.
Right, because you said that even if we have a partnership economy or a partnership, it doesn't mean there are not hierarchies still.
Absolutely.
So explain that.
Well, we need families. We need parents, for goodness sakes. We need teachers. We need managers. We need leaders. But the question, again, is how is that exercised? How is that power defined? You know, the title of The Chalice and the Blade, really, The Chalice and the Blade are metaphors, aren't they, for two very different kinds of power. The blade is the power to dominate, to destroy, to take life. And that's a symbol of a domination system. The chalice is the power to give life, to nurture life. Both men and women have that power. And to illuminate life, there's always that spiritual dimension, that dimension of care, of caring for the world, for ourselves. What gives meaning, really, to us? The things we care about.
And it seems, because there's so much talk about, you know, climate change and the need to protect the environment and our resources in order to sustain life on the planet. And in some ways, it seems as if we had to shut off part of that innate caring that lives in all of us in order to live in a world where you saw destruction happening all around you. Like, it seems in some ways we've had to shut off parts of our natural empathy. Otherwise, it would be too overwhelming to live within a world of destruction and war and violence and poverty.
Well, socialization for domination system gives you denial. Gives you denial about the pain that those, usually your parents or your teachers, cause you in such a system, you know, where violence is built into the pedagogy of learning, is built into parenting. It also gives you the power of denial about what's happening to our planet. But again, this work is about connecting the dots in different ways. And I can't emphasize this enough. You talk about the environment. The issue is not just industrialization. It's industrialization and overpopulation. And overpopulation is directly related to the denial of women in domination systems of two things: access to family planning. Men want to have the women as really technologies of reproduction, of breeding sons. Mm-hmm. And secondly, access to alternatives other than having children, to another role, okay? So in those areas of the world where you see this movement, you have lower populations in the poorest and, yes, still most domination-oriented areas. Africa, I'm sorry, I mean, it isn't just colonialism. I mean, and certainly not Western colonialism. I mean, the Arabs colonized Africa long before the Westerners got there. That's why so many are Muslim, really, today. This is where the status of women is so low in the Middle East. Violent, honor killings, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, it's the same idea that control is what defines masculinity, be it control over the women in your household or the children in your household, or controlling another religion or another nation. Latin America with its macho ethic, it's all interconnected. And this is why we have to stop thinking of these so-called women's issues and, gender definitions as something, yeah, we'll get to it someday, but they're not the main thing. You know, the main thing is the environment. Well, the environment will... I spoke at the United Nations on a panel on harmony with nature, and I made the point you can't just tack on harmony with nature to a fundamentally imbalanced system. It won't work. We have to connect the dots differently and see how all of these things are interconnected and where are the interventions. Childhood relations, gender relations, economics, really redefining economics. Capitalism and socialism came out of early industrial times. On that count alone, they'd be antiquated, but they also came out of much more domination-oriented times.
Right, because it's not just domination of men over women, but it's those with the wealth over those without wealth.
Well,
it's access to wealth.
We did a study at the Center for Partnership Studies back in 1995, which has since then been verified by studies by the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap reports. The status of women is a powerful predictor of both general quality of life and economic success. And one of the main reasons, one reason is women are half the population, okay? Mm-hmm. But another reason is because of the dynamics I've been describing, that in those nations where, for example, women have the lowest status, you see these small elites, very small elites.
So what we're looking at, and you keep going back so beautifully to these kind of four tenets of trying to create a new foundation and a paradigm, a new perspective, a different worldview on what a quality of life looks like. Because we keep trying to sell this idea of the American dream that quality of life is acquiring as much as you possibly can for yourself, and that equates to success, to really trying to open up what that definition looks like, to involving what we all are here for is to love and to be loved and feel nurtured and cared for and supported, and that we can have those things not by denying others their access to love and, ability to love and care for them, but by creating opportunities for everyone to build love and support in their lives. And so those four foundations you talk about are early childhood education, by changing the ways that we educate our children and support them and teach them about our cultural values. Also gender, how we respect and work with each other or understand each other's value in society. The third piece is the economy, how we measure our wealth as a nation, not just on our material output and our financial gains, but on our natural resources and our caregiving and support and empathy for each other. And then the fourth piece?
Well, the fourth piece are the stories.
And so let's finish with that.
Well, you know, look at the stories we've been taught, be it original sin or selfish genes. They're perfect stories.
Like our parables, you mean? The myths or fables we were taught?
Yes, many of them are idealized, not only idealized domination systems, but present them as the only alternatives. I mean, like selfish genes or, original sin, there's the same story. Something is wrong with us, so we have to be strictly controlled from the top, right?
That man is humans. Yes, humans. I keep going back to that. That we are naturally evil or need to be
controlled.
Okay.
Right. Need to be dominated because there's something wrong. Many of the fairy tales we're taught are so disempowering to girls, but also they give men the idea that the only thing about women is, being a sexual object, really. Mm-hmm. Be it Snow White or be it poor Cinderella, who couldn't even assert herself at all, just waiting for a man, a prince. And that's the other thing, we idealize those who rule, the prince and the common people. What we're seeing today is really a regression to domination economics, polarization of wealth to a small percentage on top. But what we really have to examine is also intra-household economic distribution. What's happening? How are we allocating resources? What kind of work do we value? And then this polarization will change. It has to change because economics is basically about what is and is not valued.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today has been Dr. Rian Eisler, author of Chalice and the Blade, author of The Real Wealth of Nations, Sacred Pleasure. She is also the president of the Center for Partnership Studies and the founder of the Karen Economy Campaign. Dr. Eisler, thank you so much for your time and allowing me to come into your home and talk to you about these things that are so important to you and so important to the future of our society. And if people want to find out more about Caring Economy, the website is caringeconomy.org.
That is correct. And also another website you may want to explore is centerforpartnership.org.
Thank you again for having me in your home. And thank you to my listeners for supporting Public Radio KCBX and my summer on the road. I look forward to speaking to you again next week.
The preceding program represented the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes the comments of those with divergent views. Stay tuned next for Fresh Air here on KCBX. Local support comes from SenCal Cleaning, offering residential move-in, move-out, and commercial cleaning, plus construction cleanup on the Central Coast. More information is at SenCalCleaning.com, part of the Dutch Window Cleaning Artist.